Hi everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. The World Cup group stages have been completed, and unfortunately none of the associates made it through the quarterfinal stages. But that wasn't really a surprise, and Ireland went really, really close to go through that part of the tournament with me. Is my really co-host, Andrew Dixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russ, hi everybody.
Joining us now on the Associates and Affiliate Podcast is Cricket Ireland Media Manager and Cricket Europe Ireland Editor, Barry Chambers. Welcome back on the show, Barry.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Good to be here.
Before the World Cup, Warren Jutram said the target was to make the quarterfinals and anything else would be regarded as a failure. Now, Ireland didn't make the quarterfinals, but it's hard to say that the World Cup campaign itself was a failure. You got those three wins.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't be a failure now. We did pretty well, as you say, 3-1s, two of them over full members. And I think it was just the way we played our cricket. It was a pretty exciting brand. I think we got two of the three disciplines as well as any of the top sides. I think our batting was exceptional at times, and the fielding was right up there. The bowling was a bit disappointing, but we weren't alone in that. I think all our sides struggled. The pitches out in Australia and New Zealand are really top quality, and 300, now sort of the 200 of 10, 15 years ago. I think it was really, pitches made the batting just so easy, and it made all the bowlers struggled unless they had something exceptional, and I don't think we had that in our armoury, but as I say, we weren't alone in that. You'll have seen the West Indies today really struggling, and other sides have struggled too. I think it's something, I mean, you need a balance between bat and ball, and I don't think it's there at the moment. I think the ICC is going to have to do something, at least with the fielding regulations, and give the bowlers a bit of a chance.
Yeah, so you mentioned the West Indies. I will start with the first game against the West Indies. This was the second time you've chased 300 in a World Cup, but this wasn't like the England game. This was a relatively easy win for Ireland.
It was, I mean, I'm a panicker watching Ireland, and you always fear the worst, but from that opening partnership between William Porterfield and Paul Sterling, I'm not sure what they put on, but once they get over 50 or 60, and the ease with this, I mean, the ball hardly beat the bat all day. It was a pretty small ground in Nelson, and it was a fantastic track, and just the way we played, I'd say there's a little bit of a wobble at the end, but they've got so much experience in the middle and late order. You knew we weren't going to throw it away. I think maybe, you know, Scotland or something like that, if they'd have been chasing that, they might have not got the belief of not having done it before. You know, there's probably a level between the sides in terms of quality players, but it's just the belief and confidence, having done so well over maybe 5 or 10 years now, that they just knew they were going to do it. I mean, as it sounds, it was a really, really easy win, and one which we really enjoyed.
Okay, and then you had quite a lengthy break before the next game against the UAE, which I think was fair safe to say was a little closer than you would have liked.
Indeed, I mean, we had a 9-day break, but I think we hit a cyclone in the middle of it, so three or four of those days, we had a 2-day break on the Gold Coast, and then we had 3 or 4 days indoors at a magnificent facility that Cricket Australia built, $25 million, absolutely superb, but I think, you know, you can't beat outdoor practice, but the UAE played very, very well and will consider themselves very unlucky. I'll go back to what I said about Scotland, probably the same about the UAE, just, you know, they were probably on top most of the game, but just our experience just got us over the line. You know, when you're used to winning, there's always somebody comes up trumps, and the batting lineup that day, it was the 270 odd, and we were in a bit of difficulty. I think it was 99 for 4 or not quite sure, something like that, but the middle and late order, I think that's where Andrew Balburnie and Gary Wilson, they had a great partnership. Kevin O'Brien had a cameo. I think the UAE fielding they seemed to be struggling a little bit. There was a drop catch of Kevin. If that had been taken, they'd probably have lost. But again, George Dockrell and Alex Cusack just managed to get us over the line, and as you say, it was a lot tighter than we'd have liked, but a one was a one.
And then the next game, didn't really go to plan. You came up against a very strong South African side, and you always see what they've done the rest of the tournament, and you're the best in the world struggle against a batting lineup like that, don't they?
That's right. I mean, we dropped a couple of chances, and you just can't do that. The guys batted absolutely fantastically, to be fair to them. Again, it was a magnificent batting track, ideal batting conditions, and yeah, it looks like South Africa just too good for us on the day, and And in the batting game, we really struggled against their quick bowlers. I mean, we're not just Dale Steyn, Marnie Markle, Kyle Abbott, bowling really, really quickly. They're up in the 90 miles an hour. And when you don't face that too often, it's a bit of a shock. But again, we Kevin O'Brien and Andy Balburnick, we managed to get up to over 200. George Tuckrell and Max Sorensen getting a few runs late by, so there was a bit of respectability there, but there was no shame in losing to a side like South Africa.
And then the next game, another thriller, I suppose, the game against Zimbabwe. Obviously, Ed Joyce scored a superb century, and Andy Balburn, you'll look to be run out just short of his century, and he let Zimbabwe back into the game at some stage, but a very good win for Ireland in that fourth game.
It was. I mean, this was just what we do so well over the years. Just happened to just get our noses in front. You say a Joyce, but he kind of fitted from I think he was dropped in the 30s and went on and got, you say, got a superb 100. He batted so well throughout the tournament, apart from us with the last couple of matches at the end. Any of the younger guys that were batting him said just about the calmness they brought to them. He scored pretty quickly in the tournament as he hit the ball. Him and Niall O'Brien both very positive throughout. And I think a lot of that goes down to the batting coach, Matthew Mott, who came on board for the tournament along with Gareth Hopkinson as the fielding coach. Phil brought both of them in and both did a fairly good job, it must be said. Now, the game itself, it just swung one way then the other. I think Gary Wilson saying that he felt Brendan Taylor was as good an innings against Ireland in recent times, and he didn't even give a sniff of a chance. And just sort of when we put the fielders, he just managed to find the gaps and clear the boundaries whenever he had them. Sean Williams also proved a perfect foil for him. So, yeah, look, it was a real thriller. The John Mooney catch, I suppose, was a big talking point. He felt it was inside the rope. I don't know, look, I'm sure the replays have been shown over and over in Sky. We didn't actually see them at the ground until later on. So, look, some say it, some say touched it, some say it didn't. But we came out on the right side of it, and thankfully, earned the win.
Just on the John Mooney catch, was let's be honest, an idiot in the Zimbabwean press said some very nasty things about John Mooney. I think the way John reacted in a Facebook post he made just sort of proved what sort of a man he is.
That's right. I mean, the journalist, I'll not even take the time to give him his name. It just made us all so angry. You know, that's the sort of thing that gives journalists a bad name. And Brendan Taylor, to be fair to him, and Craig Irvine, I've seen both of them coming out and supporting John. And as you say, John's post on Facebook, I thought was just fantastic, and really, you know, that's just a great response from a great guy that's done so much for Irish cricket over such a long time.
Moving on to the next game against India, Ireland batted first, scored 259, but caught India in a rather aggressive mood, and they chased it down pretty quickly.
That's right. Again, Hamilton was a superb batting track on a small ground. We were actually disappointed they only get 259. I suppose it shows how far we've come, and a lot of the associate countries, how far they've come in the last 10 years. We should have over 300, given the platform we had. Paul Sterling and William Porterfield both looking great touch at the start. And I think that we fell away in the last sort of 10 overs. As I say, we were looking for a minimum 300 and just didn't get there. And look, the Indian batting lineup, again, we dropped a few chances, but look, India, great side as well. We'll not be too far away when the trophy's given out.
And then the sort of final group game was the deciding game. The winner would go to the quarterfinals. Much the same sort of batting performance, a good start from Porterfield with a century, but then not much else to write home about with the batting in that game.
That's right. Again, very, very similar, as you said, at the end of the game. We were looking, we thought 260, 270 might have been par, but we looked in a position to get that, and we're 182 for four, we overslept. And again, with the power hitters we have down the order, but come up against a superb Pakistan death bone performance, one of the few sides that have managed to do it in the tournament. They restrict teams in the last 10 overs, and they get a bit of a reverse swing on the ball, and they're quicker bouncers. We noticed early on that they were, from even the first or second over, when they were throwing the ball in, they were bouncing it under the wicketkeeper no matter where they were. And sure enough, later on, the ball just started to do a little bit tail about them. When they're bowled into, as I say, 85, 90, early 90s, that's difficult to handle, and the lower order. just didn't manage to do it. But again, no disgrace in getting 237-240 against the Pakistan side. But unfortunately, our bowling resources just weren't up yet throughout the tournament. But that's something we're going to have to address, as will other sides, as we've seen.
And shortly after that game came the news that Phil Simmons had taken up the coaching job with the West Indies. Obviously, a big loss to Irish cricket.
That's right. I mean, it's been a colossus with us over the last 8 years. We've won basically everything we've entered into. Qualified for all the global tournaments, I think six in total. He's won 11 trophies. You know, it may come up for a bit of criticism at times for over some of the selections, but you can't argue with his record. You know, he's the guy best placed to make these decisions, and more often than not, he's got it right over the years, and you can't argue, as I say, with a man that's won everything.
And more off the field, a lot of the Irish players took the opportunity to have a bit of a go at the ICC over the plans for the next World Cup, and I think they sort of handled themselves very well in that respect.
That's also said, you say, look, I media managed them, and it's been a lot of tournaments where this one was the easiest, and that all the guys put their hand up any interview requests. I don't think we refused anything over the 6 or 7 weeks, and not just the more experienced guys, what you'd expect it from, you know, William Porterfield, Ned Joyce, Gary Wilson, those, but the younger guys coming through, your George Dockles and your Andrew Balburnies proved very willing and very articulate and very passionate about Irish cricket and Associates cricket, and I think we've done the cause of that no harm with our efforts both on and off the field. I mean, just look at the support we had as well throughout the whole tournament. I mean, everywhere I went, I tried to buy merchandise, and it was the same everywhere. Irish merchandise sold out. You can't do the other countries, but it just shows, look, with the ICC, that there's an appetite there for Irish cricket, and there is a passion and there is a support, and hopefully, I think we could tell during the tournament that we were winning the public opinion battle, and obviously, there were some, obviously, very experienced commentators as well who came out in support of us, and cricketers, and that was great to see, and hopefully the ICC will revisit that decision just to have 10 teams. I think they've had a global tournament, they've got him had more than 10 teams.
We got the news yesterday that, you know, the Rugby Union World Cup is going to be expanded in future, and you know they're not bothered if teams aren't competitive, but Ireland are competitive, and you know, I think it's safe to say they deserve to be there, or at least have the opportunity to be there, and I think they've proven it on the field, and now it's up to the people behind the scenes to make it happen.
That's right. I think we're going on here about Ireland, but I think it's fair to say, you know, you've got to mention Scotland and Afghanistan, I think the Netherlands as well, Nepal, Papua New Guinea. You know, I've seen a lot of these countries over the last 10 years, and they're definitely getting better, and the gap's closing between not only them and Ireland, but also Ireland, but, you know, sort of the lower-ranked full members. There's not much now between them, and I think it's a pretty interesting tournament. One possible solution, of fair, Andrew, is to have the qualifying tournament in England just before the World Cup starts in 2019, rather than taking the teams to Bangladesh in 2018. Mm-hmm. So if you had those countries there in England, that would give them experience of the conditions. You know, you're not going to learn much of how teams are going to perform if you play that pre-qualifier in Bangladesh and then go to England a year later. You know, why not just have it in the month before, or a couple of weeks before the tournament? That would give the sides valuable practice and give them a chance to hit the ground running at the World Cup. So that's one area they're looking at. As you say, the rugby's expanded. Hopefully cricket will do the same. I think the 14 team seems to have worked okay, so why not have at least 14, if not 16? I know there are various permutations been discussed, so hopefully the ICC will see a little bit of sense and, you know, change their decision.
Okay, looking ahead now to the sort of Irish season upcoming, you've got sort of Intercontinental Cup games against, I think, the UAE and Namibia, and ODIs against England and Australia, but I suppose the big tournament would be the World 2020 qualifiers in July, which of course you're co-hosting.
That's right, yeah. Look, last summer wasn't a particularly busy one, but this season promises to be a really exciting one. As you say, we're hosting England at Malahide on Friday, May the 8th. Australia come at the end of the Ashes towards the end of August, I think it's the 27th. And those are obviously the two blue ribbon games. But in between the T20 qualifiers, so I'm interested to see what sort of side Ireland put out in that. I know a few of the county guys are considering retirement from the T20 game. You know, we've heard Ed Joyce having a discussion, going to have a discussion this week, and possibly Niall O'Brien as well. You know, they might want to concentrate on the 4-day cricket. We host the UAE in early June, the first week in June. Looks to be in Dublin, so that's obviously the first on the path to test data, so we're taking our competition very seriously, and we want to put out our strongest teams as often as we can. Both those guys, you know, the 4-day game really suit them, and I think we'll be pretty strong in that. The T20, if they're going to be 6 qualifiers, gives Ireland a little room to manoeuvre. We've got obviously very young guys coming through, and maybe that might be a tournament they look to the future and give these guys a bit of a run out on it.
And as we should also probably mention, the women have their own T20 qualifiers over in Thailand, and if you know anybody who fancies visiting Thailand, I'm sure there's a hotel you could recommend.
Oh, yeah. It might be a bit of a commute to the ground. But anybody that's out there, feel free to come along to Sunrise Villas on Koh Samet. The women before that, of course, are playing Australia in 3 T20 internationals in Dublin, and that should be a very interesting three games in Australia, very strong side. But the Irish will have a new coach in place. Aaron Hamilton's come from, I think he's from Western Australia, so look, that'll be a good indicator for him, just the sort of resources he's got there.
I think that just about wraps it up. Thanks for coming on the show, Gary.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Andrew, let's start with Ireland, because they were the best performing team, and they did pretty well. I think we spoke in the last episode that having beaten the West Indies, they needed either the West Indies to lose all their other games, or they needed to keep their net run rate in a decent amount of order, or beat Pakistan. And in the end, they didn't manage to do either of those two things, because although they managed to beat the Zimbabwe team, they lost reasonably badly to Pakistan in the end and missed out on net run rate.
Yeah, when you look at the results, the three wins were very close, and then the three defeats were, quite heavy, so obviously that's always going to have quite a negative impact on your net run rate if you're not winning games big, and also at the same time getting thrashed when you lose. So yeah, unfortunate for Ireland, but they played in two or three of the games of the tournament, really. So something to write home about, but unfortunately they couldn't make it to the quarters.
I think it's interesting here to compare them to 2011, where in some ways it was a very similar tournament. They managed to beat the very inconsistent team in their group. In this case, they managed to beat the weakest associate, whereas in 2011 they managed to go down to Bangladesh when they had a fairly chaseable target. But they needed to win that one extra game in order to go through, and they failed. But I feel like in some ways 2011 actually did better. They were closer in some of those other games than they were in this tournament, where they were blown out of the water a couple of times.
Yeah, I'd certainly say that they certainly weren't thrashed as badly as losing by over 200 runs like they did against South Africa in 2011. So, although they were closer to getting to the quarterfinals, as you say, in many ways it wasn't as good a tournament for them as 2011. There wasn't a huge run chase. Obviously, 300 is a huge run chase, but Ireland always looks in that game, whereas they didn't against England. So, so on paper, they've had a better finish to this tournament, but I think they'd probably agree that they haven't played as well as they did in 2011. And part of that was, we have to say, the bowling attack. It was, a few medium pacers and, very medium pacers. And, a couple of spinners who, no disrespect to them, weren't getting as much turn as they perhaps could do. And, it was the bowling that let them down, really.
Yeah, I think Australian wickets are probably difficult for spinners, and they're probably difficult for medium pacers, particularly with the field restrictions. And it's obviously they had a weakened bowling attack for a variety of reasons, but they really, depending on Kevin O'Brien to get through 10 overs, was in the end, that was probably a poor selection decision, you'd have to think, because he went for more than 9 and over. And in a number of games, even the West Indies game, they gave up a lot of runs in their kind of lower middle order to the opposition, and had to chase a lot more than they should have, just because their fifth option was just not good enough.
You're absolutely right there. And a lot of teams gave up runs towards the end of innings, but Ireland, they didn't have the bowlers who were able to take the wickets as well, and that was unfortunate for them.
The other, I guess, weakness too was that the batting in low order, and I guess this is just a depth thing as much as England fell away. They had some really good starts, but particularly against Pakistan and India, what looked like it setting a really good target, the last 10 overs, they just didn't score enough runs.
You could say that again about a lot of the matches where they just didn't score enough runs. So, what more can we say?
Let's move on into the UAE. Joining us down the podcast is the UN national journalist, Paul Radley, who's been following the United Arab Emirates hither and thither across Australia and New Zealand for the past 5 weeks. Welcome on the podcast, Paul.
Thanks, Russell.
Let's, I guess, start with what went well. What were the highlights of the tournament for you?
Well, there were sort of individual highlights, really. As a whole, the team they certainly didn't deliver on what said they wanted to. I think they probably impressed a few people, in terms of the fact that they put up a fight in a lot of the games, and they weren't blown away particularly in any games apart from the India game. But in terms of the individual highlights, there were quite a few, actually. Obviously, the headline actor is Simon Anwar. Obviously topped the run scorers table briefly, looking down on AB de Villiers, Sashi Mamma, guys like that, was a fantastic feat for a UAE cricketer, and the players were calling him Sir Viv after Viv Richards, which was it was pretty good at that point. And then elsewhere, the Amjad Javed, who's a bowler really, his late order batting was a real highlight. He's probably, along with Shyman, probably the standout player in the tournament for UAE. And then Hamid David was a guy who they had great expectations for. He didn't actually show up so well in the two matches they thought they had a chance of winning at the start against Zimbabwe and Ireland. As the opposition got harder and harder as the tournament went on, he got better and better. And in terms of one individual moment that made the World Cup for the UAE guys, it was when Mohamed David, who's just a complete slogger, just mows everything when he comes into bat. Probably the highlight of the tournament was when he hit Dale Steyn for six, because that was what even though he's the main bowler in the team, when he went to the tournament and he had a chat with Akib Javed, before the tournament, he said his target was to hit Dale Steyn for six, so he achieved that, and it was a pretty great moment at Wellington.
I was just looking at his stats here. He hit the most sixes of anyone in the side in the tournament, despite only scoring 73 runs. So yeah, he had an interesting.
Yeah. He's a crazy man. When you were getting blown away by India at Perth, he came out to the. Was completely gone. It was looking a little bit embarrassing for UAE. And the first ball he faced from Ravi Jadeja, he smashed him over Cal Corner for six. And then in the last game when they played against West Indies, it was a similar situation. They just had they repaired a terrible top order collapse. And he came out to bat. I think he blocked his first ball and then whacked his second ball for six. He's a real rough diamond. It sort of shows a little bit with his bowling as well, although that's been polished up brilliantly by Akib Javed, and he's a real proper bowler now. But his batting's still really rough because he's literally only played tape ball cricket before he got into the UAE team. And he's an amazing story, really. But he definitely still plays, certainly in terms of his batting, he still plays like he's just playing tape ball in the streets with his mates.
I think the last time we spoke was a bit before the World Cup qualifiers, and we spoke then, I think, about how they might go in these conditions, because obviously they're well known for bowling a lot of left-arm spin and not so much the pace bowlers. But they did really well in this tournament, Guruj and Navid.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like you said, just before the World Cup qualifier last year, until then, UAE cricket, the sort of the whole duration of its time, had just been exclusively based on spin bowlers. And I think how they did at the qualifier actually even surprised Akib Javed, who, had to come up with a game plan to try and change the team round and the outlook and find some seamers from somewhere. But like you say, I think they did really well. Amjad Javed was
pretty good. He was erratic in a couple of the games. He's a guy who's just sort of grown up in UAE and Dubai, and, you know, it's not much fun bowling on those pitches if you're trying to be a quick bowler, but he did really well, I thought. And, yeah, like you said about Manjula Garuda, I think he's definitely the most reliable of the bowlers. Sorry, Tuke is a very reliable off spinner as well, but in terms of the seam bowlers, Manjula, he really showed up well with his left-arm swing.
And Shaman Emma, you mentioned him as a highlight. I think you mentioned a couple of times he was kind of, you weren't sure if he would even play in the tournament. So when he gets on a bit of a run of form, it's quite something, isn't it?
Yeah, you pointed that out when he was on that run. I think I was way off in terms of that I thought he hadn't got enough runs over the last year in terms of, you know, how much he had contributed before then. I don't think his place was actually ever in doubt. But it definitely seems like in the time they qualified for the World Cup, in the time, you know, that they arrived at the World Cup, he saved up all his runs because he knew that he was going to get his best, you know, best chance to be seen and his best chance to impress. And I think he certainly took that chance.
And Karim Khan, he looked quite good in where I saw him, but he didn't seem to go on. He got a cracker of a ball from Jerome Taylor in the final match.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Obviously, Karim Khan facts that Andrew promoted was, you know, built him up a lot and very deservingly so as well, because he's been magnificent for UAE down the years. He's by far and away the best UAE cricketer there's ever been. And I think you're exactly right. He got the start and looked very, very good doing it. I think from the very first scoring shot that he played, it was an absolutely gorgeous cover drive against Zimbabwe. He kept getting the starts and looking brilliant, but he just managed to find a way to get him out. I remember against Pakistan, that sticks out of the mind. He was in and he clipped one behind sort of backward square, just a sweep shot, and found a fielder that was there. It was just sort of something about the tournament, really. And I think he was a little bit unlucky. He got an umpire's call, LBW, against Ireland when he was in. And it was just unfortunate that was just how the tournament panned out for him, because I think everybody knows how good he is, even at this age. You know, he's 43 now, but I think there's word is that he's going to carry on playing, which is a good thing in lots of ways for the UAE. But if they're going to carry on being reliant on him, then perhaps that might be holding them back. But I think any of us that get to watch him would be grateful if he does carry on.
Getting to a couple of the matches, obviously they began actually with the two most winnable matches, and they were right in. They could have won either of them. They probably really could have gone either way. I think particularly the Zimbabwe game with about five overs to go, I thought they had that, and probably the Irish game as well. Where do you see them? Where did you see them fall away in the sense that they didn't manage to get over the line?
Yeah, I think the Zimbabwe game was just a little bit more experience on Zimbabwe's part, and the fact that Sean Williams actually had a fantastic tournament and he started it, you know, he started it in that game. He played brilliantly. It was just the fact that he was better on the day than them. That was, I think, the difference between the teams. And then against Ireland, there was a massive, well, there were two things. Obviously, Ed Joyce getting bowled and the bails not falling off. He didn't go on to make a big score, but he made enough runs that he made a difference. When the bails didn't fall off on Andrew David was bowling, and then later in the innings, UAE got nobody to blame but themselves when Nasser Aziz dropped Kevin O'Brien, and again Kevin O'Brien went down to make just enough more runs to get Ireland close enough to the target that they eventually got over the line. And to be fair, that's always been the UAE's failing, is the catching and the fielding. And at that point in the competition, they were actually pretty decent by their standards. They were very good in the field, but it was just that crucial moment that blew it for them.
And what was the feeling after those two games amongst the players? Did they, were they ruining it, or was it, are they, yes, kind of used to it?
Yeah, no, they were fed up about that moment, because in actual fact, talking after the very last game of the tournament, when he was sort of doing his round-up press conference, he said that was the one moment that really got to us, was that drop catch. And in actual fact, after that point, I don't know whether it's the fact that, you know, it's a long tour for UAE guys. They've never been on tour that long. Whether they're just tiring and flagging anyway, but the standards did drop off in terms of the fielding. So I think it was a big blow to their confidence, because they thought that, you know, they knew the first two matches were the best chances they had of winning games. So it was going to be pretty tricky thereafter, and perhaps
see that in their morale and their body language.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because obviously most tournaments, I mean, they didn't play a lot of games, but they were travelling. There was some.
Yes.
Obviously, they moved from Perth to, I think, Napier at one point, or certainly a long distance. Was this? Is there a point in the tournament when you kind of saw them get to the point where they just really just wanted to go home?
Well, yeah, I thought that. Obviously, they said opposite, and you know, they probably weren't wanting to go home too much because they've all got to go home to jobs, and being touring New Zealand and Australia. Playing cricket, you know, is an absolute dream for, you know, would be for any of us. But I definitely did feel that actually, yeah, that they were, once they realised their chances were gone, then they got a little bit embarrassed by India. Their confidence was sort of on the borderline each time they took the field. And although they thought they had chances against, like before the game against Pakistan and before the game against West Indies, as soon as, you know, a couple of things went against them and the batsmen on the other team showed their class or the bowlers, you know, Jason Holderbill particularly well against them, as soon as, you know, they were up against it felt like their confidence had been sapped. And that was a big difference, I think, in the last ball game.
You wrote an article, I think, yesterday on where the UAE goes from here. What do you see happening over the next 4 years? Obviously, World Cup qualification is going to be very difficult, but there's World 2020 presumably to look forward to. Where are they going? Are they likely to try and move towards professionalism, for instance?
That's going to be tricky because of the sort of visa process and the fact that it's a sort of expatriate-dominated sport. You need companies to be on side. If you look at the sort of, they're totally amateur team, however. Currently, a fair number of them are actually, you know, if they said to their boss, I've got to go and play cricket today, there'd be no worries about that. A few of them are in that situation and they do play a lot of cricket. So a lot of them would more or less be regarded as, you know, semi-professional, if not professional players. It would be, you know, it would only really further the case and they could only really do it in the UAE by getting all the leading cricket companies on, you know, all the major companies on side and allowing them to have these guys who give them a lot of good PR, you know, like Kurram gets a lot of mention in the press and the wider media. And virtually always he gets the fact that he works for Emirates gets a mention. So I think that's pretty good, PR for Emirates. And if employers, you know, for as long as they're reliant on expatriate players, if the employers can be made to really, you know, get the message that, you know, it's good PR for them having international cricketers and if they can sort of support their careers while it's not impinging on their work too much, then I think that is the best chance that they've got at present because it's going to be pretty tricky. It's going to take quite a massive change around for them to actually have, you know, professional cricketers as they're regarded in the rest of the world.
In that sense, the Emirates Cricket Board couldn't just employ them themselves?
Well, that's something I've always thought. And at least, you know, they could employ them as cricket development officers for the rest of the time who you know, do some coaching and support the development programs that they've got. But always they'll have, you know, enough time to do their training and make sure their personal performance is up to standard. I'd have thought there is a way of doing that. Whether they can, now they've probably got, hopefully they've got a little bit more scope because they have a little bit more funding than they have done in the past before last year. So hopefully they can find a way of doing that. Yeah, that'd be really handy.
And the other question, I guess, for the UAE is because they're one of the oldest teams in the tournament is, you've already mentioned Kurram. How many players are likely to go on and keep playing and what's the development pipeline looking like?
Well, yeah, I've just working on a piece at the moment, actually, that's looking at a team, if we did look 4 years down the line, looking at a team that could have a pretty good team if they pick the right sort of individuals and focused on them. But it's a matter of getting them into the team. And, you know, like you just mentioned, there's a World 2020 coming up and they've got to qualify for that now, having played at the last one and played at this World Cup. If they're going to sustain what they've done, they've got to qualify for that. And
it's going to be tricky getting the new guys in and getting them enough sort of competitive matches and enough experience at that level that they're going to replace the amount of runs that Kuren Khan could give you or the overs that Mohammed Tokir could give you. I definitely think there's the players around. It's just a matter of managing, you know, when they come in and if they do that at the right time. But I certainly think that the UAE are well placed in terms of having Akid Javid. He is a really savvy coach and he'll be able to manage that better than anyone, I think.
And final thoughts, was the tournament a success, do you think, for them?
I'd probably say no, just solely because they didn't get a win or two. I think that they probably, you know, were happy in some regards in that they probably got quite good reviews here and there, but I'd say they're definitely disappointed if they look at it, if they have a review of the tournament, but you know, they went there for two wins or at least one win, and they didn't get it. So, no, I think they'd be disappointed.
Thanks, Paul. It's really good having you on again.
Thanks, Austin.
They had a bit of a difficult tournament, I guess, because they had their two most winnable games pretty much straight up and then had to be just travelling all over the place against India and Pakistan and playing in places like Perth, which are difficult places for any team that hasn't experienced the conditions before. And they kind of fell away, I feel, at the end of the tournament. They looked a bit jaded at having missed out on the opportunity to get the wins early and having their tournament just kind of fade away.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose to some extent the format works against you. You're playing six games over the, well, you know, in over a 4-week period. It's quite stretching for amateur players, which the UAE are. They're the only amateur side in the World Cup, and so you know they performed reasonably well against Zimbabwe and the UAE and Ireland. You know, those two games were close, but then they were just blown out of the water in the remaining games and in quite spectacular fashion. But, I'm sure they'll have learned something. I think there's going to be a lot of players who have perhaps reaching the end of their international career. Hopefully, I'd love to keep seeing Kuren Khan play, but he's in his mid-40s now and he probably doesn't have that much left in him. Mohammed Tokir, I think he was very much a talk and pick, no disrespect to him for this tournament, and I don't think he'll be playing again anytime soon. So, you're going to be in a transition period for a few years, but they had a couple of good performances. Shaiman Anwar was absolutely superb in this tournament.
Yeah, and their fast bowlers as well, I thought, acquitted themselves pretty well. Obviously, we're used to watching the UAE bowl nothing but slow left-arm spinners and opening the bowling with them. So to have go in with what was mostly a pace attack and to have them not even be the worst attack in this competition was pretty good.
Yeah, it's not hard to have a better pace attack than Ireland, we have to say. But yeah, the UAE bowlers perform with quite a lot of credit. Manjula Gurruj bowled particularly well. He averaged only 19 in the tournament, so he had a decent tournament. But he didn't play every match, which was surprising. I don't know whether he picked up an injury at some point, but he had a good bowling performance against Pakistan, where he took 4 wickets. So all in all, though, disappointed for the UAE to lose all 6 games, but I think we probably just about expected that.
Yeah, surprisingly, I guess their weaknesses were their batting. The best wicket partnership was the 7th wicket, and by quite a long way as well, which, and there really was no runs at the top of the order. And if you're not scoring enough runs, particularly in this tournament, you're never going to be able to defend anything either.
That's the case in one international cricket, full stop. But yeah, that was very surprising. We know that their batting is their strong point, and unfortunately, just couldn't pull it off in this tournament. Whether it's the unfamiliarity of the conditions or just playing against better players, I don't know, but obviously something was severely lacking when it came to the batting in this tournament.
Looking across at the other group, Afghanistan, we mentioned in the last podcast, are cult heroes amongst their new fans, and they certainly impressed in that, but in the end, they also only came away with the one win against Scotland, and even that was a little bit of an underwhelming win. I feel like when in most of their matches they and didn't perform as well as they might have.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. You know, it was the, and again, like the UAE, it was the batting that very much less, you know, let them down. You know, they made 2-3-2 against Sri Lanka, but other than that, they, you know, they didn't even get past 200 in the tournament. So, you know, unfortunate for them. You know, they, I think they would have been hoping to beat England in that last pool game, but obviously England obviously decided to actually play well in that match and won. But yeah, very disappointed from Afghanistan, and you know, I think they'll go home very disappointed. You know, they would have been hoping to beat at least beat Bangladesh, and obviously they beat Scotland. But you know, I think it's a disappointing tournament for Afghanistan.
The batting, I think the statistic that really stands out for the batting was that they actually only scored 16 runs for the second wicket in the entire tournament, not just as an average, which you can't possibly keep collapsing at the top end of every innings and expect to do well. And this is something that I feel with Afghanistan has been a long-term problem as well. Their top three or four just haven't quite generally put on runs, even at the associate level, and certainly not against full members. And they depend a lot on Shinwari, who played pretty well through the tournament, and Nabi to pick up the slack.
Yeah, it always has been sort of all or nothing for that Afghanistan top order ever since they, you know, they started playing in the World Cricket League. And at the lower levels, you can perhaps have your middle order recover, but at this level, you can't. If your top order's blown away, then the middle order's going to struggle against some talented bowlers, and you know, that's what Afghanistan failed on this time. And hopefully, Andy Moles can work with them. Being able to actually build an innings, you do still need to build an innings in one day cricket. It's not all, you know, smash from ball one.
And looking forward for Afghanistan, they're in an interesting spot, I think, in terms of their development as, you know, of this team. The players that have been in the side for the past 8 or so years, and who really they talk about as this Cinderella story of them coming through. It was really catching lightning in a bottle to pick up the level of quality of bowling that they did amongst those players. But they're now kind of getting towards their late 20s and their early 30s. We probably, a lot of them may not actually make it to the next World Cup. So I think with Afghanistan, we're now going to have to see an interesting transition from a side that came out of the refugee camps and has been very cohesive in terms of the team, and will now have to be picked in and develop their talent. And of course has that problem, and there's obviously a lot of people playing cricket in Afghanistan now. There's a huge talent base to build on, but they now have this problem of how do you actually find that talent and how do you develop it in a country that doesn't necessarily have the resources to do so.
Yeah, you know, they've sort of constructed a pretty decent domestic competition. They're playing 4-day cricket, 1-day cricket in 2020. And, you know, there have been some players coming through at under-19 level. The under-16 team has tended to struggle in Asian regional tournaments. It's hard to see where things are going to be going in the future. But, you know, there's some young players who have come through. Some have come through the under-19 team into this World Cup squad. So players are coming through. But as you say, your resources are always going to be a problem in Afghanistan.
Joining us now on the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast is Scotland coach Grant Bradman. Thanks for coming on the show, Grant.
My pleasure.
Okay, the World Cup itself started with some successful warm-up games for Scotland. You had a big win against Ireland, and then you ran the West Indies pretty close, but the actual tournament itself, I think it's safe to say, didn't really go to plan.
I think the overall gut feel is that we sit here, you know, watching the finals of the World Cup at the moment, wondering and reflecting on what might have been. Lots of positives for Scotland, of course, but I think the overall gut feel is you know, really disappointed that the door of victory and the door of history really was ajar, and we just couldn't quite get through it on a couple of occasions. You know, it was a great learning experience, the whole World Cup for all of us, the players especially. But it would have been so nice to come home with a couple of victories.
Started with a game against a team that's playing very well, which I'm sure you will be pleased about, in to some extent, New Zealand. Scotland bowled out quite cheaply, but took 7 wickets, New Zealand wickets in their run chase. Must have been pretty pleased with that, but they did score the runs pretty quickly.
Yeah, they did. I think, every match, you look at the key moments of every match, and there was opportunities across all 6 of the games that we played where we had opportunities to really advance the game or take it a lot deeper to put pressure, more pressure on the opposition. And I think that moment came when Richie Barrington and Matt Machen put on a beautiful partnership of almost 100 after, we were blitzed earlier in the opening stanza from Tim Talvey and Trent Bolt, who presented the scene beautifully. They swung the ball, they nipped it around a little bit, and they had us in big trouble at 4-12 very early on. But I think as it's transpired, New Zealand sit currently, as perhaps one of the favourites going into this final stage, and they've proved against higher opposition too. I think that opening spell would have had any team in the world in trouble. So to come back, from that, Richie and Matt played extremely well, and I think it gave us all the confidence, and the players especially just gave them the confidence that we can foot it at that level. Unfortunately, we will look back at that opportunity too and see that on the scorecard that both Richie and Matt scored 50s, but really needed to kick on. We really needed to get a lot more than we did to put real pressure on New Zealand, because as it transpired, their batting was a wee bit shaky on the day too. So, another 40-50 runs, who knows, it could have been the difference in that match.
So moving on to the next game against England. Again, in that game, there was a couple of good individual performances. Josh Davis took 4 wickets. We bowled superb throughout the tournament, of course, and Kyle Kurtz with 71. But again, England outplayed you, I suppose.
Yeah, I think the scorecard will say that there's a big difference in the game. We know, and they know, that they came into that game on tenderhooks, really, after being blown away by both Australia and New Zealand in their opening game. So we always knew that the start of that game was going to be critical, and the start needed to align to bring home victory, and the first 10 overs we will look back upon that with some regret, really, I guess, in terms of having Moanelli caught down the leg side, but it was such a faint touch on the bat. No one heard it. It was early in the game, and the guys decided not to go up for an appeal, but on referral or on replay, it was obviously a clear touch. Now he went on and batted beautifully to anchor their innings for 100. We almost had him caught at mid-wicket as well, and Ian Bell perhaps should have been given LB early on in his innings too. So, we'll look back at that game, and yes, there was a big difference in the score at the end of the day. But if we had England 2 or 3 down for 50, I think we could have easily sent shutters through their ranks. Kyle Kurtz had played beautifully in that innings. Absolutely wonderful knock. And he also, I think there's another moment there where with Kyle Kutcher and Preston Momsen going so well at the wicket, if we just take a little bit deeper, then we could put real pressure on England and chase down their 300. But I think that's just experience. Those are wonderful opportunities for our guys to reflect upon and learn from too.
Moving on to the next game, I suppose against Afghanistan, from a neutral point of view, one of the best games of the tournament, but I suppose you were very frustrated for us that you couldn't quite finish Afghanistan off.
I bet for a lot of people watching, it was one of the games of the tournament. We sit back now and realise that. I guess at the time, for all of us involved in the game, probably from both sides, of course, it was such a tense arm wrestle throughout that encounter. We knew that they would be tough. I mean, we came off a victory against Afghanistan, a very easy victory, only 2 or 3 weeks prior in Abu Dhabi, where Josh Davey ridiculously well and got sixth in a 50. But we knew that Afghanistan had had a lot of fight in them, and they were as desperate as we were to secure their first ever World Cup victory. And there were many moments in that match where it tossed and turned, and it would have been a fantastic spectacle, I'm sure. But we will look back at that, and we have huge respect for our fellow associates, both Afghanistan and Ireland, especially as two of the leading associates. And they were just that little bit more desperate on the day. I think in the critical moments in the close, we just weren't quite experienced enough to walk through that door of victory, which was wide open at one stage. But even at I think 97-7, none of us felt that game was over. We still knew that there was a quality man at the crease and Shinwari, and he played superbly well. And we will look back at that, and I think that's another great learning opportunity for us to be involved in such a tense finish. Yes, we didn't get over the line at that point, but I think those experiences will serve us well.
And the next game against Bangladesh, obviously there's a fantastic innings from Carl Kurtz scoring 156. But again, it was a defeat, and you suppose you would have expected to have defended your 318, but Bangladesh were playing some of the best cricket they've played in a long time.
Yeah, we knew it was an excellent track. I think first and foremost, we're so proud of the boys and the way that we batted that day. Obviously anchored by Kyle, but it could have been anchored by anyone on that day. I think the way that the guys dusted themselves off from the agonising defeat in Dunedin against Afghanistan and came to Nelson, still very, very positive, and we trained hard. The guys never lost that attitude and that desire to really work hard and soak up every experience of the World Cup, which I'm very proud of them for. They never lost their humour. There was just a nice balance of character and a really nice attitude of learning and developing all the time. So we got to Nelson. We had a really good chat about our batting, and want to leave this World Cup without showing our best and without being confident enough to go out there and play our best cricket and just be free and to play with skill but play with freedom. And that was a big motto for us going into the Bangladesh game. Kyle was bitterly disappointed, to get out on 70 against it was a sign for him that he'd really hardened from that experience where he just tried to chip over mid on, but he was batting so beautifully that of course he hit it to the deep fielder against him. Mm-hmm. And this time, I remember having a little chat to him. I said, "Mate, you're so good. You're so in such good form. If you decide to hit the ball on the air, you hit it for six." And that he did. And he struck the ball beautifully in Nelson, and it was, just a magnificent innings, for him personally and for us as a team. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough to bring us victory, or it certainly was an innings, a team victory, but we just didn't put the other half of our game together. And, there's a couple of half chances in the field, which proved absolutely critical. And our bowling just wasn't on song on that day. It just wasn't as disciplined as we know it can be. And against international teams, we again were shown a brilliant lesson, really, on reflection that, if you're just a little bit off your game, then you're going to come second. And, quality sides, quality batting sides like Bangladesh, they just won't make a mistake on good wickets, which that one was. So, we'll look back upon that with, great pride. Everyone was just so stoked for Kyle. But obviously just, disappointed again that we couldn't quite put, both parts of our game together.
Then moved on to Hobart for the game against Sri Lanka. Tillakaratne, Dilshan and Kumar Sangakkara batting very well throughout the tournament, of course. In reply, did reasonably well with Preston Monson and Freddie Coleman putting on a pretty decent partnership.
Yeah, absolutely. Very proud and very pleased for Free, who didn't get an opportunity earlier in the tournament, but and had one chance against England, but earned his right to get a start against Sri Lanka and went in there and took that opportunity with both hands. So very pleased for him. He played some beautiful shots. He's such a skilled young cricketer, and clearly is one of the faces of the future of Scotland cricket. And he played some magnificent shots against what was an extremely challenging attack. Particularly with Malinga, many of our guys hadn't faced Malinga. We trained at Paul Collingwood. Actually threw some very, very good simulated Malingas in the nets for the couple of days prior. But being out there in the middle is totally different. So, really, really pleased for a young man like Fred to handle himself so well in the middle and bat so beautifully. He'll also look back at that and know that he will look upon that innings with great pride, but he will also know that if he could turn that into 120, 130, then we're going to go very close to putting a lot of pressure on Sri Lanka on that day. But it was a masterclass from Dilshan and Sangakkara, and I think we will look back and in a way, obviously disappointed to be on the back end of such a masterclass from a man particularly like Sangakkara, who's held in such high regard. And we'll look back and say, well, the Scotland guys were part of witnessing, his final 100 in Australia cricket. It was a magnificent knock, both from him and Dilshan.
And the final group game against Australia, I think it's probably Scotland's worst performance of the tournament to some extent, but came up against some quality bowling.
Yeah, we did. We did, and I think the pleasing thing, about that final game and about the final stanza, really for us in Hobart, we arrived in Hobart knowing that we had no chance of advancing to the next day. It could have been a really tough two games for us, but I was so pleased with the attitude of the whole crew, and the players just lapped up every opportunity. They were so excited to be playing, two of the best nations in the world on Australian soil, and for us to be playing Australia at home in front of pretty much a packed house at Hobart, was something that the guys absolutely relished and really looked forward to. They of course admire and look up to their players. It was kind of strange in the nets in the morning when we were warming up. I think a lot of our guys were in awe of training next to the likes of Steve Smith and Glenn Maxwell, and sort of were more watching them probably than doing our own training. But to be out there and matching it with them, and even in the run chase, the run rate wasn't an issue. It was obviously just the wickets that were an issue. But I was very proud of the way that the guys didn't try to survive. They tried to play their game, and they tried to win the game. And I think that's an admirable thing that we can take pride in, and we'll take away with confidence. And obviously, reflect over the World Cup. And there was lots of positives in that game. The whole six games for us that we can definitely use going forward.
So one of the big stories during the World Cup has been a lot of talk about the format of the next World Cup. Will it stay at 10 teams? What's your take on all that?
Well, I think for us, it clearly showed during the World Cup that one of the things that I think that we proved to ourselves as players, really, the Scotland players proved to themselves really that they had the skills and they are capable of footing it with some of the best in the world. And clearly, it's just a lack of experience that really made key moments and really being disciplined enough for 100 overs rather than putting together half a game. We need to learn to put together a full game. So the three aspects of that game, batting, bowling and field, needed to be on song. And often we would put together a very good half a game, but not so good a second half. And I largely put that down to just a lack of confidence. It's not a skill thing, you know. There's clearly skills there, and within the Scotland side, and it's very, very exciting to think that, you know, within the crew that we had at the World Cup, and within the small group of capable fringe players that we have available to us in Cricket Scotland, there's a very, very exciting core of young players that I believe are 2 or 3 years away yet from peaking at their best. So. I think clearly it was a condensed period of cricket for us, and I think we saw, you know, largely throughout that World Cup for Scotland, you know, that we just got more and more comfortable in that environment as the games went on. So, you know, between the six games that we played in the pool games, there was also two very good games that we were able to play against Ireland, obviously, and the West Indies at the SCG. So within that 6-7 week period, we've had 8 fantastic games of international cricket, and we saw the development, and you could just sense the development and the confidence growing within our team. So we would love dearly to have more teams, coming to Scotland and making themselves available to play us. You know, we're desperate to get more cricket and more quality cricket.
And so, looking ahead to the Scotland season for the rest of the year, so you've got some Intercontinental Cup games and World Cricket League Championship games, as well as the big tournament of the summer will be that World 2020 qualifier, which of course you're hosting.
It's a great opportunity, isn't it, you know, to come away from the World Cup, and you know, there's really nothing to be glum about for us. As a nation, you know, we'll take those lessons from the World Cup, we'll take those valuable experiences, and we just need to be smart about into place. And as I said before, there's a core of young, keen, enthusiastic, hungry players who are just desperate to keep getting better daily, and we're sure they will, you know, from the World Cup experience. So initially, first up, we've got Afghanistan coming for an I-Cup series in early June. Then we have Nepal coming for a couple of ODIs in the World Cup qualifiers. And then of course, as you mentioned, it's the T20 World Cup qualifiers at the end of June and throughout July. And that's a magnificent opportunity for Cricket Scotland itself to showcase the game in Scotland. It's a great opportunity to showcase Scotland as a beautiful country. And hopefully the weather will play its part in June, July, and the sun will shine. And a magnificent opportunity for the team to really grow from the experiences that we've gained and the valuable gold that we've picked up throughout the World Cup, and put that into place back down the league against our own associates. And it's up to us now, up to the team, really, to capture those learnings and really play the cricket that we know that should see us dominating associate cricket.
And I suppose, having missed out on the last World 2020, the players must be pretty keen to try and qualify for the next one.
Of course, we would. And particularly in our own country, it's a hugely important tournament. But it's a tournament like any other, and even though it's in our own familiar territory, we've got a tough call. There's no easy games in associate cricket. You know, we know that we step down a league from the World Cup, but we also know that there's massively important and intense battles that are always had against the associates. So we don't take any team lightly that are coming to the T20 World Cup. You know, the 12 teams will be extremely competitive, and in the shortened format of the game, often things can be evened out by the shortness of the match. So we're well aware that we're going to need to be on our game for the T20 World Cup. But in speaking to a few of the players, you know, since back from the World Cup. They're just jumping out of their skin. They're so excited to have a short refresher and then get back together and really put into place the learnings and the experience from the last couple of months.
Okay, well, that just about wraps it up. So thanks again for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Andy. Thanks for the opportunity.
Scotland, they're a team that I feel like there's almost every Scottish match you can look at some of the highlights and say, well, they played pretty well for a little while there, but they never managed to put it together for the whole match, and that basically meant that in every single match they found themselves getting behind a certain point or basically being blown out at a certain point, and then there was too much to come back from or they weren't in it for long enough. And although in every single match you can look at a couple of players and say, well, they did pretty well, or a period where they did pretty well. In the end, they never really looked like they were going to win anything except for the match against Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think especially, it's an odd turn for Scotland because the warm-up games went so well for them. They absolutely hammered Ireland and then ran the West Indies close, nearly chased down over 300. But then the actual tournament itself started and it was just a disaster. Despite the 3-wicket margin, they got hammered by New Zealand in that first game. Got thrashed by England, and then a very disappointing defeat to Afghanistan. And then against Bangladesh, scoring 318. Cal Kurtz has scored that superb 156. But again, very few other batsmen actually joined. The next high score was 39, and then to let Bangladesh actually chase that down, the bowling, Josh Davey apart, it has to be said, was very poor.
Turning to the tournament as a whole, Andrew, and I guess here it might be useful to have some historical context on how associates have gone in World Cups and also how the weaker full members have gone in terms of the number of wins they're getting its full members. Since the beginning of the World Cup, which is obviously the first one, is in 1975. There's been 141 matches between associates and full members. There's been 14 wins in those for associates and a tie. That's pretty consistent throughout the history of the World Cups. In the first five World Cups, there were 58 games and five wins. We had a bit of a peak in 2003. In the last two World Cups, we've had seen three wins and 40 matches. So about 1 in 10 winning percentage seems to be kind of where we'd expect the associates to be, and we saw more or less the same thing in this tournament. We saw two wins out of 20, and that's probably not so different to where we actually see the full members as well, in the sense that the West Indies in the last even 8 years now have really only won about 25% of their matches against the teams, and the Bangladesh is a bit below that. So getting a 1 in 10 winning percentage this World Cup pretty much played out to where we'd expect, I think you'd say.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think we're perhaps hoping for maybe one more win, but I think three wins, obviously all by Ireland, which is a little bit unfortunate. Two wins for Ireland. Be hoping for maybe one of the others to have beaten a full member. Obviously Afghanistan and Scotland both had chances against Bangladesh, especially Scotland. As we said earlier, scored over 300, but what we got from this World Cup was pretty much what we expected in terms of the number of wins over four members.
But having said that, I feel like there has been a little bit of a reduction in the size of the talent gap. The players are actually much more likely to be homegrown now, and the players are actually better. It's just that there is still a little bit of a lack of depth through them, and this is it comes out, I guess. And we can see it in the games that were almost won in the UAE against Zimbabwe, for instance, or Afghanistan against Sri Lanka, where once we start to look at the fourth and fifth bowling options, they were able to get the runs and get away and defend, and weren't able to defend targets, which if they'd had just one more bowler, they would have been able to do.
Yeah, I think it would almost be more interesting to look at the number of close games in this World Cup as compared to others, and see if there's been an increase over time in that, because in many ways your wins you can sometimes put down as a freak occurrence, but if you're being competitive, to use that David Richardson term, in defeat, and that almost is a better metric to judge your progress on, and I think the Associates have been more competitive in this tournament than they were certainly in 2011 and in 2007.
Yeah, I think it certainly helped too that the qualifying was much closer this time than the previous time, and I think certainly in the last World Cup we looked at Canada and Kenya and said, well, they're not actually even the best Associates at the moment, that they had probably declined significantly since they'd qualified, and that didn't help.
That's certain. I think you're obviously playing the qualifier in New Zealand as well in the similar conditions that they were going to be in the World Cup meant that the teams playing were likely to be the teams best capable of competing in this tournament. So that was one of those very rare sensible moves from the ICC. Obviously, that's changing. The qualifier for the England World Cup is in Bangladesh. Obviously, very different conditions between those two countries.
The other thing I'd like to touch on is the standard of professionalism. Obviously, the Associates are now mostly professional, and we can see that in the way that they train and they go about things. But I feel in some ways the gap has actually continued to grow a little bit, in the sense that the full members have also become more professional over this period. And fielding, for instance, the Associates tended to be some of the better fielding teams because it was one way they could reduce some of the gap between them and the full members. But most of the full members now have really make that a focus. And I think for the most part, the Associate teams are actually probably some of the worst fielding teams in the tournament. And they lack some of those analysis and the specialist training as well that the full members are able to bring to matches.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. Yeah, as we've discussed on previous episodes, resources are often at a premium in some Associates, and you have to, if you're spending your money on a coach, then maybe a batting coach, you need a bowling coach, and then the fielding coach maybe gets left out because obviously there isn't necessarily the budget for it. But as you say, fielding used to be something that the Associates matched the full members on, or even better the full members on, basically because there was no real specialist fielding coaches going back even 10, 15 years ago, and now there is, and the Associates have been left behind, I think, in the fielding side of things. So if they can improve their fielding, and there was some pretty ropey fielding from the Associates, has to be said, and then they can sort of start to close that gap a bit more. Although, as you said, the gap is a lot closer than it was.
So looking forward then to the next World Cup, it's still likely to be 10 teams, notwithstanding the general feeling by and an awful lot of comment that it shouldn't be, especially by prominent journalists and prominent players. It's disappointing that it's likely to be the case. I think we said it a few times that if we want teams to perform and players to perform in one-day cricket, then we should make one-day cricket what they're aiming for, and if we want them to perform well in Test cricket, we should make Test cricket what they're aiming for. And the message really being sent out by the ICC and cricket generally is that T20 is what you should aim to be good at if you're an associate player.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. The death knell for ODI cricket has often been sounded, but I don't think it's ready to die just yet. But again, in 2020 cricket, I think you need a solid grounding in 50 over cricket to be able to succeed in 20 over cricket. And people may think that's old fashioned, but I still think you need that, that grounding, the fundamentals of the game to be able to build a decent 2020 innings. I don't think concentrating on 2020 is the way to go if you're helping develop Associates. I think they need those longer forms of the game to play. As for the next format, obviously we've gone from before the World Cup, that the 10-team format was set in stone, to the 10-team format is being discussed at a meeting in April, the exact format of the World Cup. So there has been some movement. I think we're going to end up perhaps with some nonsense first round sort of thing like we had at the last World 2020 and the next World 2020. I think that's probably the best we can hope for. I don't think we're going to keep this format, and nor should we. It's not actually a very good format. It's better than the 10-team format, but two groups of seven is a pretty poor format for a World Cup.
Yeah, I feel like we're probably going to end up with something that's going to resemble the 2007 World Cup, in the sense that it'll have a really long, everyone plays everyone second stage, with the exception that they'll make sure that teams that need to be in the second stage don't miss the second stage, which would be, was obviously what they considered the problem with the 2007 World Cup.
Yeah, yeah, obviously that. You know, they did that with the World 2020, and I've no doubt they'll do that with the ODI World Cup. Although, of course, they could just decide to say, well, look, none of the associates made the quarterfinals, so we're justified in reducing the World Cup to 10 teams.
It's a bit galling, though, I guess, when we look across to a sport that's very similar in the context of its development and growth and its unevenness between its teams, and say, oh, isn't it awesome that rugby has a 20-team World Cup, and then they put out a media release saying, we're really looking to expand beyond 20. 20 is just not enough for where we're looking today.
Yeah, and you know, as a lifelong rugby league fan, having to praise rugby union, you know, really, really gets me. But you know, I'm going to. Obviously, the current World Cup has 20 teams. It's played in England this year, then Japan in 2019. That's another thing that rugby does. You play in the World Cup in a developing country. I can't imagine the ICC organising the World Cup in Ireland or Scotland. But then they say 2023 may be larger. At a conference in London, the World Rugby head Brett Gosper said allowing fringe nations into the event would allow them to promote the sport in their countries. He goes on to say, as a sport grows and we conquer new markets, the discussion is about looking towards expanding the World Cup rather than contracting. And it says a larger World Cup would offer the chance to sell the sport into new markets, as well as increasing the potential revenues from the tournament in terms of TV deals, sponsorship, hospitality and ticket sales. So, you know, rugby union, as opposed to cricket, sees more teams as leading to more revenue, whereas cricket seems to think that less teams leads to more revenue. And, you know, I have to say, I think the rugby union approach is the one that is going to lead to more revenue in the long term.
There's a little bit of other cricket going on around the world. There's a Central American Cricket Championship being played in Panama. It involves 8 teams. One of them's the MCC. There's a Panama A side along with Costa Rica, Brazil, El Salvador, Peru and Mexico. And there's been some interesting results so far. It's still being played over the next few days as we're recording now. But I think one stands out between Panama and El Salvador.
Panama batted first and scored the not insignificant sum of 264 for one, which would probably say this is a 2020 tournament. 264 for one would be, okay, impressive in a 50-over game. You'd wonder why they weren't scoring more when only losing one wicket, but 264 for one in a 20-over game is absolutely spectacular. And then they then bowled out El Salvador for just 16, so won by 248 runs. We don't know what the batsmen score, but that's just a sensational result and almost unbelievable.
I don't think the tournament's fallen apart either as a result of El Salvador Australia. In fact, they've come back in the next game and lost to Mexico by 56 runs. So these games aren't the end of the world either. It's probably worth adding.
No, they certainly aren't. Mismatches tend to be forgotten about pretty quickly, and I don't think the big deal that some people seem to think they are.
And also in the Americas, the combined Canadian-American team, US team, has gone to Argentina to play a series against the Argentine women, and Argentina is come out on top in all three of those matches. They won them by 6 wickets, 45 runs, and then 7 wickets.
Yeah, I think this probably says a little bit more about the strength of Canadian and American women's cricket than it does about the strength of the Argentinian side. Obviously, very poor performance. So it was, this wasn't an official tour. It wasn't organised by USACA and Cricket Canada. It's a group of players who have got together to try and promote women's cricket in North America. And obviously, this first tour hasn't really gone to plan for them.
Yeah, I think it's, well, the word from women within those two organisations is that neither are particularly interested in women's cricket. So certainly, we should commend them for taking it on themselves to actually organise this type of tour.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I know with your ICC America's not organising any women's cricket as well. Obviously, these you know, these sort of series are very important for the development of women's cricket, because, you know, if you know, USACA and Canada might not be taking women's cricket seriously, but Cricket Argentina certainly do, and they're being robbed of a chance to play in a tournament by ICC Americas, so this is good opposition for them as well to be able to, you know, keep playing and keep developing their game as well.
Yeah, and hopefully they will be able to get back in to some sort of official structure and send a team to the World 2020 qualifiers, in if not this one, obviously, then at least the next one.
Yeah, I'd certainly hope so. Obviously, the future of the regional bodies is very much up in the air at the moment, and you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens with that.
Finally, the African Division 1 T20, which is a fairly important tournament, being the qualifier for the World 2020 qualifiers, is being held in South Africa. It will involve five teams: Ghana, Namibia, Kenya, Uganda and Tanzania, and it will then be followed by a one-day match between Botswana and Ghana after the tournament that will determine which of those two teams will go into World Cricket League Division 6.
Yeah, there's two teams, as you say, go through to the World 2020 qualifier, and you'd probably suspect that would be Namibia and Kenya. Uganda obviously didn't play too well in World Cricket League Division 2 earlier this year, so I can't really see them pushing Kenya and Namibia. So, but you obviously, it's 2020, and you know, anything could happen. So we'll see what happens. But I think, you know, Kenya and Namibia are a pretty safe bet for those two qualifiers. And as for the one-day game, Ghana and Botswana, both two quite evenly matched sides, but I think Botswana probably just pip that.
Yeah, so the one-day match will be pretty interesting, and it's certainly good to see. I think we've criticised the ICC on a number of occasions for using T20 qualifiers as for one-day qualification purposes. So in almost all the regions now, they have actually used a one-day match to determine who will be going into the one-day structure, which is good.
Yeah, so certainly your Asia obviously still had 50-over competitions, and Eastern Pacific use a 50-over match, and Europe will be doing in May between France and Norway. So, yeah, I'd rather be seeing a return to the days of the regional 50-over tournaments, but you know, one match is better than no matches, I suppose.
News, Andrew. Some good things to say about the ICC. We've probably actually said quite a few nice things about the ICC so far in this episode, but they've contributed to the relief fund for Vanuatu as a result of Cyclone Pam.
Yeah, obviously, you know, the terrible events in Vanuatu, and I think cricket has been affected as well. I think pretty much every cricket facility on the islands have been damaged in some way. As obviously, you know, not just cricket, but you know, the entire community in Vanuatu. But the ICC, along with Cricket Australia and New Zealand Cricket, have contributed $200,000 to support UNICEF in their aid and recovery programs. And you know, obviously, we have to, you know, congratulate the ICC for doing that, and you know, it's great to see them helping out in that way. And I'd certainly urge all listeners to try and to contribute what they can as well.
And briefly, we'll talk about on the next episode, the USACA elections are today as we're recording, so we'll find out by then what's actually happened. But it looks like a normal USACA election in the lead up.
Yes, it certainly does. Lots of people who you wouldn't want running a cricket organisation are running to be able to run a cricket organisation. And same old for USACA.
Yeah, lots of leagues who may or may not actually exist seem to be voting on whether or not those people will be running as well, which is, as you say, same old, same old.
Yeah, vote early and vote often, I think, is the saying for that Glastonbury will be using, allegedly.
And I think that's all we've got for this episode. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Russ.